mortgage deduction one?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, colleagues,
right.
Why don't we get started? Today is obviously distance learning day. All our audiences.
Oh, excellent.
All right.
All my colleagues are over testifying on that.
That's right. Today, colleagues, at the end of today's session, we're going to have a work session on the bill that we carried over from Wednesday, House Bill 3025. That's the bill related to the estate tax. But what we're going to do for the next hour or so is to talk about governance. It is Friday. And so I'm going to open an informational hearing on the topic of shared services. Colleagues, you remember that last week we had a conversation about the academic side of the house as far as OUS goes. You know, we talked about shared academic services, the provost, the program approval, all of that. Today we're going to hear about the administrative side of the house, the shared administrative services that, as I understand it, is actually the bulk of the chancellor's office. The personnel working in that area are working on the area of shared administrative services. And one of the challenges that we have as we're making changes in governance is, how we can continue to do shared administrative services in an effective and creative way while giving institutions more flexibility. So with that, we're honored to have the wisdom of Chancellor Perlensteiner. And so, George, if you'd come up. Colleagues, later this morning, the State Board of Higher Ed is going to be conferring on Chancellor Perlensteiner the status of Chancellor Emeritus, which he will, a title that he will carry for life, and that is richly deserved. And just on behalf of this committee and the legislature, George, I just want to thank you for all of your years of service to Oregon, Portland State, and at OUS. Your skill and passion have done really incomparable good for students in this state. Just I'm remembering back to when we were first talking about governance changes, and the national experts were showing us where Oregon was placed. Okay, this is not necessarily a good thing, but in terms of the level of state resources, which was very, very low, but in terms of our success at student completion and degree attainment, we're towards the top of the nation. And if you look at the intersection of those, low state investment, high student attainment, Oregon is a national leader, and I think a lot of that is due to your work, George. So, on behalf of us all, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. For the record, my name is George Perlensteiner. 2237 Spring Boulevard, Eugene, Oregon. I now give an address and not a title because I am now the former chancellor of the Oregon University System. But I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. I have been coming to the Capitol now since 1989 or late 88 to meet with various committees, and I have to say this is the first time I've seen more blue uniforms in the building than suits. It was a very interesting day.
The lobbyists stay home today on gun day.
Clearly they do. As Representative Denbrough indicated, for almost 9 years, I was the chancellor of the Oregon University System, but I also served as the vice president for finance and administration at Portland State for 7 years. I was the vice provost and chief financial officer for the University of Oregon for 3, and I was the vice chancellor for administrative services for the University of California, Santa Barbara for several years, and was the associate vice chancellor for administration and for facilities for OUS. And I say all that because that is kind of a framework for what it is we're going to talk about today. Many of the things deal with administrative services. So in all those positions, I had responsibility for administrative and support services and systems for either a single campus or an entire system. But I think even more pertinently to this discussion and this topic, for 6 years I headed the City of Seattle's Department of Administrative Services, whose entire mission was providing and enabling shared services for a city government that at that time was larger in its scope, larger in its employment, larger in its budget than the entire OUS system plus OHSU combined, to give you an idea of the scale of city government in major cities in the United States. Recently, I was able to complete a set of documents for the Oregon State Board of Higher Education that I will be sharing with its Governance and Policy Committee on the 16th of this month. And, you know, in typical academic fashion, it's a big paper. And it includes both a rationale for shared services, a reasonably comprehensive list of the dozens, actually there are over 100 services currently shared within OUS, a suggestion as to which of the OUS functions might migrate to Representative Dembrough called last night an enhanced HEC, and possible legislative provisions to establish a shared services enterprise. And I'm going to briefly go through several of those this morning and then leave some time for questions, because I think really questions are what we are here to discuss, rather than me babbling away in professorial fashion, which, as some of you have heard me over the years, I do with at the great aplomb at the drop of a hat. I think that shared services is part of this overall higher education reform package that you are considering in this session, both in the House and in the Senate. Senate Bill 270 is dealing with institutional boards for some or all of the universities. That is one piece of it. You have been working on either an Office of Post-Secondary Education or an Enhanced Higher Education Coordinating Commission. That is a part of it. That is a part of this overall reform package. And I think the third piece of it deals with a shared services enterprise. Today, all these things are combined within the State Board of Higher Education, but they are really very different functions. And they are things that, as we consider how we want to enhance student success going forward, how do we then deal with each of those so that we make sure that we're doing things as effectively and efficiently as possible without undermining things that are working? And so as we move through these things, I'd like to spend some time making sure that we recognize what works today so that we don't undo that as we try to make things work better for the future. So I think that shared services is that third important piece of higher education reform. And I think it is essential that we consider shared services if the other two, the institutional boards and the enhanced HEC, are to serve the state interests and to advance 40-40-20. They all are pieces that are essential. Shared services can be the glue that holds Oregon higher education together to provide consistent information and consistent approaches. Shared services can be the way to keep tuition affordable and contribute to student access and student success. And shared services is a way to reduce costs, improve service, and provide consistency. So it has all of those pieces, not just in Oregon, but in other states. But I would argue that for shared services to work effectively, they should be provided or facilitated by a separate entity. And this is a departure for me, and I fully admit it, but it's one that is not a part of a state agency. Or a part of a state agency, which is not a state agency, or a part of the state agency bound by the strictures of being a state agency. Those of you who were here in the last session when we considered Senate Bill 242, and many of you were, Chair Dembrough was, Representative Johnson was, Representative Harker was, I mean, I guess most of you were, you recognize that the value to the Oregon University system of not being a state agency was in fact a very important efficiency and effectiveness value. And as we move to a different structure, if we do, we have to make sure that we don't undo that value by sweeping the services, which are, as Representative Dembrough indicated, the bulk of the activities of the system office now, sweep those back into state agency status, because then you're bound by the same strictures and the same time frames and all of the other, if you will, red tape that affects all state agencies and does not allow then the kinds of things that we're going to talk about this morning. To be successful, a shared services enterprise must be customer-focused and should be mostly customer-governed. And that's an important change from the way that we've done things in the past. And it shows the evolution over time of how we view higher education in this country and in this state. That, in fact, the institutions, as they receive fewer and fewer dollars from the state, demand and deserve greater autonomy for operations. And yet, and therefore, are as customers, have to have a voice in the kinds of services that they receive. And yet they still could and should, for efficiency purposes and for effectiveness purposes and for consistency purposes, share a great deal of the services which they currently share, and perhaps some that they don't now do. To be successful, a shared services enterprise should not be part of an organization like OUS, which has governance functions. In the old model, it made sense. If you are, though, going to devolve responsibilities for governance to institutional boards, if you are going to move responsibilities for policy to an enhanced HEC, then, in fact, to leave shared services with an OUS board that is governing some of the institutions but not all makes it very difficult to create that kind of customer-centered flavor that you need for shared services to be effective statewide. And so I would argue that if you're going to make a governance change in one of the arenas or two of the arenas, you really ought to consider making them in all three of the arenas and make that an integrated effort on your part that, in fact, says this is how we're treating each of them, and we're not treating any of them in the way that we have done in the past. There are a lot of states right now that are creating, redefining, or expanding shared services. I mean, some of them that you've probably heard of are the State University of New York, which is going into a major expansion, which is technologically based, for sharing a variety of services that are more than just back office functions, but include even a lot of the aspects of pedagogy. And we'll get into some of that. But that is a major investment on the part of SUNY that is, in fact, a change from the way they have done things in the past, but, in fact, is hopefully going to allow them to serve more students more effectively than they've been able to in the past, given the reductions in state funding that they, like virtually everybody else, have received. The state that has cut budgets the most in the last couple of years is not Oregon. It is New Hampshire. And New Hampshire, in fact, is looking very definitely. They have changed their structure to focus much more intensively on the system being a shared services enterprise. And that, in fact, is something that they are implementing as we speak. And I had the opportunity a few weeks ago to visit with them, to visit with their board, to try to understand what was motivating and driving both them and the presidents as they sought this new approach to providing shared services. We're going to talk a little bit more about the dollars that they expect to save as they move forward, because New Hampshire has probably gone further in quantifying that than have most of the others. For a very limited set of services in New Hampshire, which are treasury, controller, budget, capital, purchasing, audit, and general counsel, they and their consultants expect savings of up to $9.5 million a year. This is a four-campus system that serves about 30,000 students. So in comparison to Oregon, it's very small, very small. And yet they expect to save about $9.5 million a year by being able to share those functions, most of which are financial. They're not talking about other things at this point. It gives you an idea of the opportunity that is available. One of the things that makes that a possibility for them is in fact how they will approach purchasing and link that purchasing into the accounts payable system so that you now have an integrated approach to the way that you buy things and pay for things so you don't have individual processes with individual things going on. That
I can come back to
and these. That's how they expect to get many of their savings.
Please continue.
Excuse me. OUS last spring, or last summer, I guess, had estimated, this is the reverse of this, that if you did not share services that are currently shared, that it could cost about $20 million a year within our system. In other words, if you said we're going to start over and everybody's going to do their own thing, that's about what you would expect. That is actually a little lower than what you'd expect based on the New Hampshire numbers, but it's sort of in the same kind of a ballpark. That there are numbers, there are monies to be saved by sharing services. There is a relatively greater impact for smaller institutions for sharing services than for larger. Makes sense. If you are a small user and you get the opportunity to be part of a volume buy, you're going to get a lower price. If you're a big user, your opportunity, you know, you may still save some money, but you're not going to save as much because you already have some volume that will allow you to achieve that. For the smaller users, or the users often in rural parts of the state who don't have suppliers or opportunities or services available in their local markets at reasonable prices at all. Some of the reasons that you see shared services as we go through the report, which at some point we may want to do, one of the reasons is that you can't even get certain kinds of services in certain locations. And so you wind up getting them through a shared services enterprise because it's really your only option. And you see that in many states. There are new opportunities possible as well. I mentioned some of what SUNY is doing, but I spent some time last week in Georgia. And the presidents there, the presidents of the universities, not the system, the presidents have asked that financial aid packaging be shared. Something we don't do, something a lot of places don't do. Why? Pretty simple. All of us are bound by the federal requirements. Most of the money is federal aid, and the rest of it's kind of programmed based on what that federal aid is. We always, you know, look at the Pell Grant and the various federal loan packages first, and then you supplement that with institutional aid or the state need grant or any number of other things that you might be able to do. But the federal government essentially provides the baseline. And that baseline is the same, no matter where you are in a state, no matter where you are in the country. And therefore, many of the, particularly the smaller universities in other states, are saying, well, why don't we take those back office functions, not the counseling functions, not but the ones where we actually package the aid, which is a ministerial function, and have that done centrally. University of Wisconsin is sharing courses using technology. I mentioned SUNY Wisconsin's doing much of that as well. So the sharing opportunities occur in many dimensions. But the forces of inertia are powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Georgia's chancellor and presidents stressed to me last week the importance of moving fast to make key decisions. You can fill in the details later during implementation, but if you don't make the fundamental decision quickly, you may never get around to making it because of the forces of let's not change anything. The Oregon State Board of Higher Education currently has the power to share services, and it does so in many cases. You know, for many, many pages in this document, I go through shared services that are currently provided in areas like student support, in areas like academic programs. You did talk about academic programs. You probably didn't talk about student support and all the things that happen in there now. Budget activities, financial oversight, financial services, which are by far the biggest. They go into pages and pages of just individual specific services. Data collection and forecasting for consistency information, that is important. Legal services, affirmative action reporting, compliance with policy, risk management, insurance, labor relations, human resources, internal audit, advocacy, purchasing, contracting, employee benefits, and on and on. I mean, there are many, many services that are currently shared across the universities, either by the a single university providing the service for the others, or more commonly by the Chancellor's Office providing it on behalf of all of them. I would suggest that we make sure that we not overlook in any implementation any of the things that currently occur, lest there be some untoward and unexpected consequences. But having said that, delaying is death. You got to make sure, I think, that as you move forward with your various governance changes, that if you make some of them now, set up the framework to make all of them now, so that you don't wind up with discordant arrangements in future years. Another thing that we have considered is expansion to other entities beyond the Oregon University system. And that could include OHSU, as you can imagine, as another public university in this state. It also could include the independent Oregon universities, with whom I've had considerable contact over the last several months and who express considerable interest because they're in the same line of work. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they need all the same kinds of things and are open to discussion of how can we save money and improve service. Because really, it's all about improving service and saving money. And if they can do that, they are willing to participate. And finally, do you extend this to other parts of Oregon education at some later date, either community colleges or ESDs or school districts? The sharing can occur in a couple of ways. It can occur on a case-by-case basis, service-by-service, on a statewide basis, or it can occur in regional compacts. And I mention that because in certain parts of the state, that may be the way that you get critical mass. You don't have critical mass for universities, but you may have critical mass for education. And that is something that can be considered at some point. And that argues that in any transition period, that if you were to establish a shared services entity, say this year, with implementation in a year, that you have to take into account drafting the legislation broadly enough to allow the opting in of more than just the seven public universities, to allow the opting in of OHSU, to allow the opting in of the independent colleges, to allow the opting in of the community colleges, and ultimately perhaps even some of the K-12 schools. So I would argue that you may want to consider establishing an enterprise now. An enterprise that transfers some of its powers from OUS at the appropriate implementation time. But most importantly, it's not a state agency. How many times have I said that now? How many times do I want to say that? Yeah. But it has to be a governmental entity. And part of the reason for that is the accountability. But part of the reason is the way that certain of the services can be set up. For example, under federal pension law, you have governmental plans. They are available only to and through governmental entities. But all of our universities, including OHSU, currently have governmental plans. OUS administers most of those today. The point of that is you don't want to get into a situation where you undo some of the savings and benefits you currently enjoy by the way that you set up the structure of a new enterprise. So you don't want to make it a 501c3. You want to make it a governmental entity the way you did OUS, the way you did OHSU. You give it the powers you want to give it, but it is a creation of this legislature, this state, and it's designated as a governmental entity. If you were to create such an entity in this session, you'd probably need to spend the next year figuring out the details of how it would actually operate. What I have proposed in the paper and what our board is being asked today to consider is that any entity like that be governed by a combination of its university members, the presidents, and two or three citizen members appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. And the reason for that balance is pretty clear. You want it to be customer-focused, so you want the customers to be part of the governance structure. But you also have public interest you have to maintain and protect. And so you want to, and so how do you hit the right balance of that? And so I think it's mostly customer, but you have to have some public interest, and so two or three citizen members are proposed as well. You can argue about the details of how that works, but the importance of keeping both those dimensions in mind, customer service and public interest, is critical as you set up an entity like this. You probably wouldn't actually start operations until 2014. You would continue as is with regard to current services as they are currently provided for a year and then transition them in another year. But I would suggest, too, that in any legislation, you make the powers broad to allow expansion later so that you don't have to come back and redo this. You set up the framework. You set it up in a flexible, broad way. You set it up in a way that customers have an opportunity to opt in. And then if they decide to opt out, they do so with notice provisions that allow the impact on the other customers, if you will, to be mitigated over at least some period of time. But you do not require customers to take the service. That's an important distinction. These are not mandatory. These are voluntary. They may be voluntary that in a way that says you're locked in for a period of time. In fact, when we had a board committee meeting about this, we talked about it with the presidents, about if you make a long-term investment, you're agreeing that you're going to be there for the life of that investment. But you're not locked in perpetuity. It is your choice to get in. It is your choice to get out. But you do it within a framework. It's important to do that because if you're going to have this be a customer-centered, customer-focused enterprise, you cannot have it conflated with mandatory you must be in situations. It gets more complicated as you look at some of the issues with regard to the impact on the smaller users, if you will, the smaller customers, if larger ones exit. And as you look at that kind of a situation, what we've talked about is the notice provisions that would be in place. And it may be that the dollar allocations that the state makes in its appropriations may be slanted more in your funding formulas towards those smaller institutions so that they can, in fact, afford to operate. But I don't think you want to do it with a differential rate structure within the shared service enterprise. I think that would create, considerable discontinuities. Across the country, rising costs and technology-enabled opportunities are causing states and universities to share more powers, more services, and different services among their universities. Holding down tuition costs and helping assure achievement of state goals are the primary drivers. We in Oregon have an opportunity. In the last session, you set a goal. You set the 40-40-20 goal as the state policy, and you put that in statute. So we know where we want to go. We now have achievement compacts, another statute you passed in the last session, that tie funding, state funding, to the outcomes you're trying to achieve in education. And you are potentially about to have strengthened state oversight through an enhanced HEC or Office of Post-Secondary Education and greater university autonomy through institutional boards. Shared services could help Oregon, could help all of us achieve those goals by saving money, holding down tuition, and assuring the consistency of information we need to map our progress. I deliberately didn't spend a lot of time on detail. I have lots of detail. because I wanted to give you an opportunity to at least understand the flavor of what I'm thinking would make sense for Oregon with regard to shared services. And the takeaway on that really is just a few points. You can save money by sharing service. You can improve service by sharing service. You can get into areas you otherwise couldn't get into by sharing services. It's the old MRI thing where when MRIs were new, you had to share in order to afford them. When you get new technologies, and we are in the realm of new technologies in instruction in particular, it may be that you need to share in the beginning or you don't do it. So you have opportunities there, but you have to be customer focused, keep the public interest in mind, and that would argue, I think, for a separate entity that is mostly governed by the customers, but one that is flexible enough to allow the expansion of services to more than just the public universities in order to both build greater volume and drive down costs, but also to allow Oregon to achieve the 40-40-20 goal more effectively. The private universities in this state are part of 40-40-20. You put it in that way. This gives us an opportunity to help us and them reach our goal. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would entertain any questions, comments, observations, or arguments. I'm now in a position I can actually have discussion. This is the first time in 25 years.
Thank you very much, Chancellor. That was a very, very clear presentation. I think it really, I mean, for me, it clarified a number of things. And
copies? Is it in the?
Yes. Well, will we be getting copies of your report, George?
As soon as I've shared it with the board committee, I talked with Victoria this morning, and I can email it to her, but I really do have to share it with my board first.
We look forward to that. Vice Chair Harker had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, just to reiterate what the chair said, thanks so much. Great insights. I'm really interested in what you've been seeing and hearing lately on some of these trips that you've had to Georgia and things, New Hampshire, etc. Fighting inertia is a pretty big challenge in this arena, and I'm wondering what presidents and chancellors around the country are thinking in terms of developing these shared services that are technologically based, in terms of developing the build or buy scenario. As you probably know, I was involved in an endeavor like this before. I'm no longer involved in that endeavor, so I can have really free conversations about it. But I had a lot of experience dealing with different university systems around the country. There are campuses that try to build their own systems to address whatever issue. There are consortia, Qualicoeus being one of them, that attempt to provide within academia shared services of the payroll and purchasing and back-end financials. And there are commercial entities that do some or all of these things. I'm wondering what you're hearing and what your thoughts are about how this state should move forward.
Chair Denver, Representative Harker, thank you for the question. What I'm hearing is mixed, to be honest with you. It was interesting in Georgia last week, for example, there was a lot of concern about the centralized payroll, which is outsourced to a firm I will not name. And in New Hampshire, they're doing things themselves. In New York and Wisconsin, which are looking at the instructional areas, they're developing those themselves. But I also know there are some states that are saying, well, why don't we just piggyback on what MIT, Stanford, da-da-da-da-da are doing as they expand out. And I think that what the shared services enterprise will give you is a forum in which to make that decision. Right now, that decision is made one-off by campuses or top-down by boards. And this, if you tee it up right, you can actually have that conversation more effectively. When I sent this draft around to staff, it was interesting the comments I got. And technology was a good example because they came all over the board. I mean, some of them were saying, well, let's just put everything in the cloud. And then others were saying, well, then we don't have any control over security. And it just sort of the byplay on my email was indicative of the issues that have to be addressed. Nobody seems to have a gold-plated, this is the right way answer to that. Each one is developing his or her own. It's own, I guess. They don't have genders when they're states, do they? But what this enterprise would give you is a forum to actually deal with that. And you know, one of the things that I'm suggesting is if you create this, you give this enterprise the same kind of bonding authority that you authorize each session for universities, so that they have the ability to make capital investments if they need to. But there is nothing in here that says you will build or you will buy. There's nothing in here, in fact, that says who will do the service. One of the principles that the board will be asked to adopt today says that if you have a shared services enterprise, that does not say they will do the service. It merely says that they will facilitate it. It may be done by one of the universities. It may be done by some third party. It may be done. The idea is, how do you get the right level of quality and the right level of costing in order to drive down tuition, which is really ultimately the primary goal that we've set ourselves up for in the system.
Mm-hmm. And George, just to follow up, so your thought about the consortium, the group that would include presidents, citizens, and presidents, currently you're thinking university, but if it were to expand, then we would want to have the flexibility to include, other presidents or, some representation from the other sectors. Your sense is that this would be a government body that would be also subject to public meeting laws. Is that what you're thinking of?
Chair Dembrough, yes. And I'm not anticipating that non-public entities would be part of the governance. So in other words, if a private university wanted to buy some of the services, that did not make it part of the governance structure. It became a customer relation, as opposed to public entities, which could be part of the governing structure. And it gets back to this distinction that we draw about what is the responsibility of the legislature versus public organizations and a more arm's length one with regard to private. For the private institutions, what we're trying to do, if we do this, is to give them an opportunity to save money that will help them achieve 40-40-20. But it's not a governance kind of a thing.
Yes, thank you. Rip Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. George, I just wanted to second the other comments, too. But excellent report. I appreciate all the work you've been putting into this. I have a lot of questions I get asked. But to begin with, I think one of the questions many of us have been wrestling with or pondering as we talk about governance changes and more independence and autonomy and so forth, but it seems that we haven't yet defined what's that critical mass that will need to exist, I think, from day one to ensure that any of these governance modifications don't create harm or don't create hardships within the OUS system. Do you come close to or do you make recommendations on a base level of shared services that need to exist at the minimum? And then perhaps there could be a dynamic plan for how it could be expanded to incorporate others as this board you're talking about can make recommendations about, yes, this could be helpful, this could be an efficiency measure and so forth. But are we at the point where we can say these are the essentials that we need all seven right now sharing because it makes sense for everybody? And beyond that, then we can consider ways to expand that to open it up to, as you say, the privates and perhaps colleges and everybody else.
Chair Dembrough, Representative Johnson, yes and no.
Okay.
yes in that the process that we are unfolding within the State Board is to create work groups in each of the functional areas. Work groups that are made up of campus and chancellor's office representatives and outside folks who will in fact begin to look at those kinds of things and make recommendations. We would have a year of transition in 13 and 14 to kind of prepare that plan. In addition, the way that this is worded is that anybody who leaves a current shared service, and as I say, there are probably 100 of them, has to give adequate notice, and generally that's about a year, and which couldn't be triggered till 14. So you've got basically 2 years to work out the details of how you'd actually function. Some of the things, you're asking really almost two questions there, because some of them relate to your Office of Post-Secondary as well as to OUS, and some of the things you may require from a state governance standpoint for consistency's sake. And those are some of the areas that that deal with sort of defining data definitions, as an example. It sounds not very important. It's extremely important. Because if you want to have any way of tracking whether or not you're making the kind of progress you want to make, you have to have consistent information across the whole sector. And the data definitions and the reporting frameworks are how you get there, and it's just an example of something that you may require. It may not be done by a shared services entity, or it may, but nonetheless you're setting up a framework that does not deviate or vary based on who you are. There are some of the things in here where there are opportunities, but they may not require all seven. They may in fact require only a critical mass. So certain of the things will require all seven for at least a period of time. And we've had conversation about that. I mean, PEB is one that we will be in for at least the upcoming biennium, which is at least 2 years, and it may be more than that. But the point of that is that there are some things that will continue. Other ones, campuses may choose to go in or out. And I'll give you purchasing as an example. We do not centralize purchasing now. It is a completely decentralized operation, except for Southern and PSU. PSU does a lot of the purchasing work for Southern. And it may be that if we move in a direction of having a kind of robust system like New Hampshire's thinking about, where you integrate purchasing with your accounts payable and other things, you may in fact want to expand that beyond just those two, because the real savings come on that back end. And then you get into the question of the financial systems and how integrated are they. That may be another area where, from a state policy standpoint, you want to have a greater degree of integration, just as you do now, for consistency of information. Well, that may then drive how you approach a purchasing system. I don't know if I'm being clear enough on these. There are some things that I would argue are fairly small as items, but don't make any sense to be done seven times. We have some very, I would call them esoteric provisions with regard to certain kinds of personnel things. We don't have a centralized personnel system, but we do have all seven doing certain things through the chancellor's office in the same way, even though they're not required to, because you get two or three instances of that activity each year, system-wide. You don't even know which campus is going to be. So it doesn't make sense to have seven campuses figure out and develop the expertise to do that transaction. And so, you know, they all do it in the same way through the chancellor's office. There are things like that per force will be shared, I think, just because it's not in anybody's interest to change that. Pensions were the one that I thought would be the most clear because of federal requirements that everybody would share. But even there, we can find it is certainly less expensive and more efficient to have everybody in the same. We have 403B and, you know, we got all kinds of plans. But technically you could separate. The question then is it worth it, and what are the savings and the costs of doing that? And that's what we're looking at now.
Thanks, George.
Follow up.
say quickly, because I think everybody's got a question.
Well,
George has to leave at 9:30.
Yes, yeah, okay. I'm glad you mentioned PEB, because that's an example of, it's one of those shared services that everybody participates in, but yet it could also be a cost saver if, you know, Jay Canton's presented us with a proposal that, you know, the university could save, OUS could save something like $67 or $8 million worth of biennium if they could self-insure. So that's one of the tensions, obviously, you run into. Mm-hmm. But the other thing I would say is that you mentioned third parties, you know, using them could find out there could be applications for third parties to find efficiencies too. We also could run into some tensions there if, in fact, we find that a third party could provide that service more efficiently than currently a state agency does that we're using within this process as well, because we run into personnel, employment issues, and so forth. So I applaud what you're laying out there. I appreciate it. I don't want to sugarcoat the serious conversations that will come as if this agent, if 40-40-20 truly is the North Star and we're serious about doing everything we can to try to find efficiencies, that will be a great goal, and I appreciate what you've done.
Thank you.
So we have Gallegos, Greenlick, and Wisnew.
Chancellor Emeritus.
Not yet.
Okay. Well, I also am Emeritus, Professor Emeritus. When I asked my president what that meant, he said, it's Latin, Joe. He's a priest. And but I said, well, what does it mean? He said, well, it means you can keep your email for the rest of your life. So with that, I do want to thank you for your presentation. I just had some questions. I'm also on some other committees looking at the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Human Services. It's fascinating to me. I mean, we're in this whole transition with these state agencies, and particularly the implementation of lean methodologies. And some of your discussion of your vision seemed to sort of parallel some of those concepts in terms of elimination of waste, for example, being the principal concept of lean methodologies. And I guess I'm asking if that's sort of guiding your thinking at all in that, and if it is, it has profound implications for cultural change in academia and the decision-making hierarchy. You talked about customer sort of being the guiding principles, and so yeah, I guess I'm just asking if that's sort of a parallel of your thinking with this.
Chair Denver, Representative Gallegos, I appreciate that statement very much, because it's something I neglected to say. One, the cultural change that is essential is twofold. The first is on the service provider's standpoint, to be customer, very customer focused. But the other one is within the academy itself. It requires, we are as an enterprise one of the least likely to want to share anything of any enterprise in Western civilization because of the way that we evolved. And so it will take a lot of focus there. But I would point out, I used to teach higher ed history at PSU, and one of the things that happens is you reach an inflection point at different times in the history of higher education in this country. And I think we may be at an inflection point where we can, in fact, begin to make some important fundamental cultural changes that are focused on the challenge that we really have right now is we need to educate more students more successfully than we've ever done before, and they have less money than any of those we've ever served before. And so our production model, if you will, is not suited to that. As the academy, we recognize that. I mean, that's why you have MOOCs. They came out of the academy. We know we have that challenge. And so what this is intended to do as well is to help us get our mind around the cultural change we need to make within the academy. When I say that keeping tuition low is the main goal here, that becomes the frame within which you can always check back to see, are we doing what we said we would do? If I meet with the faculty senates, and I did for years meet with the faculty senates, framing the question is important to getting the right kind of conversation and then getting the right conclusion. That's how we wound up in Oregon with lower state investment, but better results than many other states. We frame the question with the faculty differently than historically it had been done. And that's what we got to do here, too. And I thank you for asking that, because I didn't say it, but I should have.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Rick Greenlee. Yeah, just a comment before my question. I don't think the objective is keeping tuition low. I think the objective is keeping costs low. We've learned that the increase in tuition isn't related to the increase in costs. It's related to the reduction of state support. So there are many other drivers of...
I take the point. Thank you.
To move from the sublime to the ridiculous, I try and put this in concrete terms. I'm trying to imagine the institution you're talking about. I wonder if you could say, is this more like, say, the Lottery Commission, which is told to go do its job and its objective is to reduce revenue, or to go do your job and the objective is to reduce costs, or is it more like the education service districts that are designed in very specific ways to affect the cost of education in the schools, or is it like something else? I mean, I think of the Port of Portland. I mean, what's it really like?
Representative Dembro, Representative Greenlee, it's hard to draw an analogy. I don't know much about the Lottery Commission, to be honest with you, but I don't think it's like an ESD, because an ESD is bound by so many strictures and regulations. It's much more flexible than that, in my view, because if it doesn't have flexibility, I don't think it can, in fact, reduce cost.
Right.
So and I don't know what the appropriate analogy would be, because I don't know the Port of Portland well enough. What I'm viewing is an entity that is still public in nature, public in purpose, but very flexible in operation and customer focused, and you know. If we have something else like that in the state that has those kind of elements, then that's probably the closest.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chancellor, for your comments. I'm a visual person, so I look forward to the email or your testimony, so, because I'd like to give you some comments back. I think shared services are important. We've been briefed on that by Mr. Cannon. And one of the things I asked him, and you didn't comment on that, is community colleges inclusion in that shared service model. This body used shared services to balance our budget, I think, in 2007 and 2009. Every budget, I was on the Ways and Means Committee, and every budget that came through said we're saving this much money by using shared services. And another thing that Representative Greenlee brought up is the ESDs, you know, High Desert ESDs had approval of two other ESDs, that they're using a model you talked about as far as having representatives of each school they represent be their overseer, not an independent board. And I think that's a key thing, because if that's you're working for the presidents, I think that's a very good point. It was interesting, and I'd like to see why, read more about why you said it should be a government entity and not a private, and also I would be interested I hope that the shared services we will look at, or your proposal has in there, that they could be private services, not government-provided services. I am a believer in Governor Daniels' quote that anything in the phone book that's listed twice should be privatized and not given to the government to run. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant, yes, it could be private. I mean, it's how a service is provided it could be a third party, which makes it private. It could be by the entity itself, or it could be one of its members on behalf of the others. So with regard to community colleges, we obviously could consider expansion to the community colleges on a voluntary basis, but that isn't what I was trying to do here. I was trying to leave it open so that if they wanted to join later, they could, and that's why making the framework flexible is important.
Just one, I forgot one of my other comments.
Sure.
Your comment, do it now, I agree with you, but doing that now in this building, we have to have a work group and we have to have a pilot program, and so it'll be, I don't know how long, but I agree with you, to get the true benefit, we need to do it now. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for that, Rep. Whitson. And colleagues, I think, you know, what's being looked at, and it's actually called out in Senate Bill 270. We just had a work group on this yesterday, that there will be a kind of technical group that will be coming together between now and the February session with concrete sort of, as I understand it, implementation kinds of proposals. And that is going to be, you know, at the same time, there will be a process. I think I referred to it a couple of weeks ago as governance 2.0. That is, what is the best status for the regional and technical universities? And because so much of the, you know, the interest in maintaining shared services comes from that basic principle that we articulated, that we don't want to harm the small, you know, the regional, the smaller colleges, universities, they are, as you can imagine, their presidents are very, very, and students and faculty, very, very focused on the issue of shared services, shared administrative services, as well as academic. And so, you know, I think what we are kind of wrestling with now in terms of the drafting is how to create that framework without crossing every T and dotting every I, but, you know, expecting that we'll have a lot more specificity to bring to the legislature in February. Does that make sense to you in terms of the kind of timeline you're thinking of, Chancellor?
Representative Dembro, as I said earlier, if you're making some of the other fundamental changes in this session, then establishing this one in as a framework in this session might make some sense. If you're not, if you're evolving those, and maybe the real decisions on will be made in February, then it makes sense to deal with it in that way. And so, since I don't know, I have not been in the building in a month, so I don't know what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, neither do we. Be patient. Yes. And colleagues, let me say, you know, a court, yes.
Clarity is on its way.
Spring. I just poked my head out and see if my shadow's there.
With respect to the timeline, you know, we are anticipating that the drafting on 270 will be, I think, in its final form in a week's time. And we will have, as well, a next draft of House Bill 3120 in a week's time. And so we'll be able to, I think, you know, really start talking about those in more detail and how they're going to come together. We do, you know, as I've articulated, you know, our goal is to try to get them put together before they go to LFO to Ways and Means. That would be my hope, because the work on, you know, the governance issue and shared services and the institutional boards are really interlocking. And the only way that we can really understand the, you know, the budgeting needs and you know, the merits of the overall package is to see them as a package.
Is the House bill a version of the Senate bill, or is that the higher ed governance thing? I don't remember.
Yeah, ours is the, ours 3120 is the higher ed governance, and then Senate bill 270 is the institutional board. I will say also, colleagues, that I think we reached agreement yesterday on the issue of board composition, and the institutional boards will have a student, a faculty, and a non-teaching staff member. And, you know, at the very least, they will be present, the faculty and staff member will be present as non-voting members, but the university board may agree, may decide to allow them to vote. Rep. Johnson?
Just to differ slightly, I think what I heard in the meeting was that the universities could, in fact, present those names, but there's no guarantee that they would have to. So maybe I'm hearing it from a little different vantage point, but that they could provide a slate of candidates who would have faculty, students, and so forth, but there's no guarantee or requirement that be a part of that slate that's put forward to the governor. So
maybe you and I are just hearing that from a little different vantage point, but we can discuss that.
Yes, we can discuss it. I believe I'm correct. Chancellor, thank you very much, and we look forward to continuing to pick your brain, even when it is a brain emeritus, if you'll indulge us in the future.
Well, thank you, Chair Dembro. I would be pleased to continue working with you as you move forward on this. I have no idea what an emeritus brain is like. I asked the two living emeritus chancellors last night what it meant to be an emeritus chancellor, and quite frankly, they couldn't actually say much about it.
They keep their email.
There you go.
Thank you.
I think they could, but they just didn't want to do so in public.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chancellor. So with that, I'm going to close this informational hearing on shared services.
Well, I thought Mr. Cannon was going to come up. He's not going to speak on this.
Oh, yeah.
He flew the
case. The Chancellor's free to say what he wants now.
Okay, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3025. Victoria, why don't you remind us what this is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3025 establishes the Next Generation Fund, directs the state tax revenue to Next Generation Fund, appropriates monies to Oregon University System to fund higher education and to Department of Education to fund early childhood education programs, applies to revenues received by Department of Revenue on or after January 1, 2015, takes effect on 91st day following adjournment, sine die, and you do have dash one amendments before you.
So the dash one amendments specify that the fund will, the proceeds of the fund will go 30% or a third to early childhood, a third to community college, a third to university.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This bill will go down to Ways and Means when we pass it. So, Vice Chair Harker.
Yes, Chair Dembro. I move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments, which are dated March 28, 2013.
Vice Chair Harker moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated March 28, 2013. Any discussion of the amendments, this division of a third, a third, a third? Rep. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I guess my comments are more in tune towards the bill itself.
Okay, why don't you hold off?
Okay.
Any further discussion of the amendments? Okay, any objection? Yes.
Objection.
Okay, Cassie, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Gillian?
Excused.
Representative Borson?
Yes.
Representative Grinley?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative
Wisnett? No.
Vice Chair Harker?
Yes.
Vice Chair Huffman?
Excused.
Chair Dembro?
Aye. Okay, the amendments are adopted.
That being the case, Chair Dembro, I move that House Bill 3025 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Harker moves House Bill 3025 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there discussion? Rep. Wisnant.
Representative, thank you for bringing this bill, but I had the experience a few years ago that I went with my money and my family, we went to Hawaii for the Maui Invitational Basketball Tournament, and I'm standing in line behind a doctor from Wilmington, North Carolina, and I says, he was telling me he has season tickets for the Carolina basketball games, and I said, that's great. How much is that, you know, that must be very expensive. He says, yeah, it's $1 million. And I said, wow. He says, yeah, I take an insurance policy out on my life, so when I die, the university gets $1 million, and I get to go to the Carolina basketball games, and it's a pretty good seat. My point is that I think this should be voluntary. We shouldn't automatically ask people that to give up what they worked and earned for to the state for universities and for other things that the good representative put in his bill. But I cannot support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I respond to that?
Sure. Yes. Since this is your bill.
Yeah. My reading of the bill is not. It applies to taxes that are collected, not endowments to universities or anything like that.
It's taking existing estate and dedicating it to the real estate.
Yeah, but you can reduce estate tax by doing other kinds of things. I think the point.
Rick Greenleaf.
Yeah, I suspect it's not our job. It's Ways and Means' job to deal with what backfills the 100. What do we lose with the 100 million that comes out of the general fund to the estate tax? This is 200 million biennium. So it would be about 100 million. Is there any sense of what we give up? We can take that out of K-12 or take that out of the university.
$1 billion.
Ways and Means can say, oh, okay, well, we can reduce university support because now we're getting 100 million here. I mean, is there any sense that that's not going to happen? I know it's hard for us to figure out what goes on in that black box down there.
Oh, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any sense of that?
You know, that's always a question, it seems, when we have dedicated funds, mm-hmm. right? Whether it's from the estate tax or from the income tax, the lottery. The only thing we can be sure it doesn't happen with is the sales tax, because we don't have one. But that, too, is part of the conversation. Whenever the subject of a sales tax comes up, will this just, you know, what will be the impact of that? Rep. Johnson, you wanted to...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. I appreciate our colleagues' attempts on this bill, too, but I'll be a strong no. From my perspective, it would, I think, further enshrine the estate tax, which for me and I think for folks in rural Oregon is a very regressive tax. I think it hits unfairly towards rural property owners, rural farm owners, rural estates that people have worked hard their entire lives to build up what they have when they pass on. Their heirs are oftentimes having to liquidate everything to pay the tax on that estate, and I just feel that this is one more thing that will continue to embellish or encourage the state to hold on to a tax that I think is harmful for our state outside of the metro area and outside of the valley. So, great. I totally agree with a stable source of funding for higher ed. Absolutely. I'm totally on board with you there, but I just don't think this is the way to get there.
Again, my response would be that I believe the voters approved the estate tax, and it's, you know, if the voters wanted to do away with it, then that could come up for a vote again.
Right. Rep. Gorsuch.
And I totally understand what Rep. Johnson's saying. Since we do have it, and since we do have our problems with education funding, it seems like a decent way to go. Although I also hear what Rep. Greenleaf is saying about, you know, what other things don't get funding. But I think, especially considering our desire to improve education funding, especially for K-12, I would support this.
K-12 is not included in this.
No, but if you can support the other things, then you have, right, you have more funding. Good point. Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
I would just add to that, you know, I do note that the voters of Oregon have again confirmed their belief in the estate tax, and I think for good reason. I remember the eloquent comments that Rep. Gallegos made last time when this bill was first presented about, you know, the notion of investment, and that if you're going to have an estate tax, the whole notion of an estate tax is investing in the next generation, literally. Both those kids at the pre-K level, to get them their skills up to the point where they can do well in K-12, have the skills to succeed, and then to give them those higher access to higher education. If there is an appropriate use of the estate tax, and I understand that some people may feel there is no appropriate use for an estate tax, I believe that if we have one, this is a great use for it, and I really thank the representatives for bringing it forward. Is there any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, Cassie, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Williams?
Excuse?
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative Greenleaf?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Woodnick?
No.
Vice Chair Harper?
Yes.
Vice Chair Huffman?
Excused.
Chair Dembrough?
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. This bill will go down to Ways and Means. I will close the work session on House Bill 3025. Colleagues, anything else for the good of the order?
Yes, some excitement on Monday.
Yes, just that. I hope you all received my email yesterday about the hearing on Monday. Monday is Campus Safety Day, folks, and so we will be hearing actually competing bills related to the issue of concealed carry on campus. And I look forward to a lively conversation.
Oh, yes.
Okay. With that, we are excused.